Well, as everybody knows, I haven't been around lately, and I canceled out a whole bunch of interviews just because of my coughing, but I really didn't want to cancel Stephen Harrison, who's sitting here, out. He wrote a book called Doing Nothing, Coming to the End of the Spiritual Search, and I really wanted to get some of his thoughts on audio as well as in book form. So I'm going to just start right out, and you're going to have to be mostly talking, by saying, why don't you tell people what the basic thesis of the book is?
Well, the book was really written as an exploration of how the mind works and how it creates a conceptual framework, which really keeps us from experiencing the actuality of our world, our life, and consequently relationship. And the ideas of enlightenment, of spirituality, of psychology and therapy, all the process-oriented approaches to understanding are, in fact, problematic because of the fact that they move through time. They're always taking us outside of where we actually are into this potential future, which we can call enlightenment or resolution or whatever. And so I'm challenging those concepts, and along with that, the concepts that go along with spirituality and therapy, the ideas of enlightenment, the idea of even teaching. And trying to bring the reader through this book, which is a little difficult, to bring the reader through language, through word, into silence, into the moment. That's the attempt.
What is silence?
Silence to me would be the space or the ground out of which all of our conceptual world arises. It's really the background, what we normally think of as the background. But I think what I'm suggesting here is that it become the foreground, that it become not what our self arises out of, but what our self is.
I find a real interesting dichotomy in your book, which I know it won't please you since you're really taking a giant step out of dualism, and that is that it feels as though you wrote a book in order to take people who don't exist actually into a place that doesn't exist actually in time, which doesn't exist actually. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I think if I could have written a blank book, expressed it through that, that would probably be the purest expression of what I'm trying to say. Short of that, I'm trying to use language in a way that is a little hard for the mind to wrap around it and grab it. Like the title, Doing Nothing, is a conundrum in itself.
Yeah.
You
mm-hmm.
can't take an action mm-hmm. and have it be nothing. And so doing nothing is kind of a contradictory phrase. And so when you try to grab that phrase, your mind can't quite do it. And so the whole book is like that. It's like a series of Zen koans minus the Zen. Take away the framework, the Buddhism, and but you still have that mind grappling with itself.
And what are you hoping will happen out of, obviously, you're out on the road publicizing the book. You went to a lot of trouble to write it and publish it or get it published, and it says that you're writing another one, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. I have another one coming out next year with Putnam.
And what are you hoping will transpire out of all of this?
I think that the book, if it's has a useful quality to it, will do one of a couple things. One, it will take the reader into their own silence. And I think also it has the potential to initiate a kind of dialogue. And what I've been experimenting with and discovering in the book talks and the public talks and dialogues I've been doing is that there's a potential in the human being to have a non-hierarchical, non-authoritative dialogue. That in a group, its potential is to have a kind of intelligence that arises, which is not directed and which is not structured or controlled by an individual. In particular, myself. And so that's part of what I hope comes out of this book, is that experiment continuing around the country. It gives me a way to initiate those kinds of discussions. And that's, I think, very interesting, given the kinds of problems we've had with hierarchical spirituality in this country and the whole problem with the sex and money scandals that go along with it.
Mm. Yeah, I like the idea of there's really nothing to do on the spiritual path. I think I've arrived at that after having gone through many renunciatory paths and other, I have difficulty, though, of not being me. You know, that idea that I don't exist. I can understand I don't exist as I perceive myself or as I perceive the world. I understand there's a lot of illusion around that. Well, who was sitting here talking to you or to Kathy or to Elizabeth?
Sure. Well, I think what I would say to that is something seems to exist, but we make the very quick presumption because we've been conditioned to it that what exists is me and you, me the observer, you the phenomenon that I'm observing. That's a presumption that we seldom question. So I'm not suggesting that nothing exists. I'm suggesting that something exists. We're trying to understand what that is, and we're looking around for clues. The first clues that we come to are this dualistic language. We learn this from a very early age, that there's a me and you. And I'm just suggesting that we wipe that away and start again to try to discover how the universe is actually built. So we may discover in the end that there is an actuality called me, but when you look for that, internally and externally, you really can't find it. When I look for, you know, where is the location that I'm observing the universe from? You know, and first, most people go to behind their eyes and they say, oh, well, it's somewhere in my head. But then something's aware of that. And then we go to whatever that place is and we say, well, what's aware of that? And we find that the place of awareness is really not findable. And then you take it into quantum physics where you try to say, well, at least I have a body. That's who I am. The quantum physics describes the material world in such a way that you can't find location of a particle. And so either way you go, either internally or externally, you can't really find location. And yet we have this embedded concept of I am, which by its nature describes a very definite location. And so I'm just challenging that conceptual framework, mostly because it doesn't seem to be working very well. It seems to be the basis for a lot of our societal structures and our personal structures that are very conflicted and creating a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm. Sound more like a vibration in the universe, a wave that comes in from the ocean that I peak and then crash.
Well, the discovery of language or word to really give form to that is so difficult. Particularly in the English language, this is why you start to move into poetry, into music, into art, because language, the very structure of English language, is very difficult to describe what we're getting at.
Yes, a prison.
Yes. And so, again, the experiment in talking, in this discussion, in writing this book, is can we use language in a way that points to something and takes us beyond that something at the same time and not get caught up in the conceptual framework? And the difficulty I see in a lot of the spirituality that we've now absorbed into our reality and have sort of come to accept, like enlightenment, is that it's conceptual. And it seems as though there's something called enlightenment, but we really don't take the time to go back and say, well, what the heck are we talking about? What is awareness? What is consciousness? What is enlightenment? It's all embedded now inside our reality.
I always think of enlightenment as the rabbit that's tied to the greyhounds in the racetracks, that no matter how hard they run, they're never going to catch up to.
That's right. And if you were a really smart greyhound, when you stop running,
that's it, right? Which is what your book is about. It's hard to talk if you don't say my. It feels as though there's maybe infinite realities all coexisting at the same time, and in one of them, you exist and you're doing what you're doing, and in another one. You're who am I? You're Ramana Maharshi's question, but at the same time, do you think it's possible to step out of the you that's existing and writing and so forth and so on in some permanent way so that we become pieces of the whole?
Well, I think that the idea of stepping out of something presumes that there's a place that we start and a place that we're going to. Conceptually, then we're moving from this place to that place. And I think the actuality of our situation is that we are only in one place at a time. And that one place is, in fact, the universal. Mm-hmm. That whether it's a concept arising out of space or whether it's space itself, that is the universe. that is the contact with the universal. That is the so-called enlightenment. It's not a place out there. It's a place where we are. And the only thing that obscures that is this constant movement conceptually, because really nothing's happening. We're not going anyplace. We just have a thought which is projecting this place we're going. And that slight veil of movement which mind creates, that's the only thing that takes us out of what we're calling enlightenment. I think enlightenment is actually our natural state, and that the human condition is enlightened. And in fact, this is why we don't need a hierarchy and an authority and a mediation as someone who's going to interpret the universe to us. It's right there. And the thing that connects you and me is that, is our human condition.
I think what I'm questioning is, isn't there a place where some people do need that hierarchy? Where some people, at whatever point they are, it's so hard to discuss because sure. To take it out of whatever time is, whether we've invented it or not, doesn't matter in a sense, because we experience linearity. At 75, I can tell you I'm not what I was at 35. There is some linearity somewhere.
Sure. And I think that you know, I have a 1.5-year-old son, and that child needs my authority.
Right.
Without a doubt.
Right.
He needs someone who's got control over him to a certain degree and can keep him from being run over by a car and from putting the wrong things in his mouth and all that.
Not only that, he needs someone to help him understand himself as an individual, and that's quite the opposite of what your book's about.
In a concrete sort of way, yes. But now the question is, at what point does that child become an adult? In other words, at what point does the autonomy arise where I'm no longer looking for an authority? And I think that the problem with the spiritual searcher is we too easily put ourselves in the position of a child in relation to an authority. And we regress back to this childlike state, which requires authority. And we don't actually require authority. What we need to do is take responsibility. And because we don't like to take responsibility, we say, oh, you're enlightened, I'm not, you'll show me the way.
In a sense, isn't that what you're doing?
What I'm doing?
Yeah, you're telling people that the way is to stop having a way.
Yeah, but I'm also saying, once I've said that and you've heard that, throw the words out.
Yeah, don't you actually say throw the book away.
Yeah,
I was impressed with that.
Don't take this discussion, don't take the book, don't take any language and make it into something more than what it is, which is simply the attempt to communicate with symbols something which is fundamentally non-symbolic. And if you and I can discuss using words but with attention to the fact that those are just symbols, those symbols will not implant themselves in our memory as something other than what they are. Because really what we're discussing, what we're connecting, what we're doing is something on a fundamentally different level, which you can describe as consciousness or energy.
The Rajneesh group here in town had a place called the Institute for De-Hypnotherapy, and that was their whole goal, to de-hypnotize people, to wake them up to what you're saying, pretty much, that I don't need a Pope, and I don't need a Muktananda, I don't need Ashama.
Whatever, what was his name? Oh, anyway.
Okay, that,
sure.
Well, their base camps, and if I get some help or some energy, that I have to decide to climb whatever spiritual mountain there is or whatever spiritual valley there
sure.
is.
But Stephen's saying, pardon me for putting words in your mouth, this is a question. But you're saying, I understand, that there is no mountain and there is no valley.
Right.
There's nothing to climb and no ski slope to go down.
That's right. I'm saying we are actually already awake. We don't have to become awake. But because of this regression, because the thought and its hold on us attempts to maintain that hold through any means possible, one of the great means of maintaining is to regress into this childlike state where I'm not awake, I'm asleep, and I need you to wake me up.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that, in all honesty, we have to admit to ourselves that it's not true, that I don't need another person to wake me up, that in fact our relationship to each other can only happen as a relationship when I don't want anything from you, including enlightenment, and where you don't want anything from me, including enlightenment. And now we have a relationship. It's autonomous. It's an adult, responsible relationship. And that, I think, is worth exploring. This relationship of you're above me and I need something from you is not a relationship. It's mutual usage.
So, Stephen, I do want to get into some of your history and how you got to where you are. If in fact it was it, but, are you suggesting to the people who are listening right now, or will be in the future time, even if time doesn't exist, I love this, that, age-old conundrum, that they simply stop all spiritual seeking immediately?
I think they sure. The individual can continue the spiritual seeking if they so desire, but it's recreational spirituality. It's spirituality because there's no good movie tonight, there's no good music concert tonight, so I'm going to go hear some spiritual speaker. Well, that's fine, but let's call it what it is. It's recreation, it's entertainment, and it's a form of social interaction. But it has nothing to do with a movement from an unenlightened state to an enlightened state. It has nothing to do with what we would call spirituality. It has to do with our own boredom, our own movement to entertain ourselves.
I call it occupational therapy for being alive.
Sure, sure.
But something's alive.
Everything's alive.
Oh, everything's alive.
The whole of life is vibrating with itself.
Where'd you come with all this? Let's hear a little bit.
Well, okay, let me talk about that, because if I describe a series of experiences that came to a certain point, and after that point I was different, don't we really have a restatement of the enlightenment game?
Yes.
And now whatever I describe I did to get to that point is going to be what the listener then wants to do? When I look at that question, have I transformed, have I changed from something which was before to something which was after? I don't find any point of change. I don't find any point where what I'm talking about and describing wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. That there has always been this ground of awareness that has always been accessible, always been available, and there's always been thoughts arising and passing away in that ground. And that shift of perspective to the foreground, the thought, the concept, or the background, which now becomes the foreground of the field of awareness in which we are all connected, has always been there.
Yeah, I understand that, but it's a recreation to hear your story of having been a monk or a renunciate or a tantric.
As long as we understand that whatever story I tell is fiction.
Right.
Is the story.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that respect then, you know, I started out, I would say, when I dropped out of college. I was going to an Ivy League college, and this was in the midst of the Vietnam era. And as I'm sure you will recall, the country was really in a great kind of upheaval. There was kind of like a social malaise that had grown over the country. And I felt that very directly. I was raised as a Quaker, and there was a great deal of discourse in my family and my personal life about what to do about that. I was of draft age. And so I ended up finding that the academic approach to understanding was really not adequate. And I left. I went to Canada. And from there, I traveled around the world multiple times, spent a great deal of time in Asia and in South America, and pursued whatever I could find as far as an approach to understanding. That included long periods of meditation, particularly in India and Nepal, and contact with some very obscure, but I would say powerful teachers. But the discovery for me was not in all of that, but the discovery was finding that at the end of all of that, I was still there. All the qualities which I started with were still there at the end of all that process. Now, that's a very interesting thing, because what I discovered was I'm a human being, and that was the point of connection, was my humanness, not some state I had created to get away from that.
So there's something... There is something that if you look the right way, that is a human being.
Well, I think that's where we all are. It's inescapable. We can try to escape it. We can try to create this perfection or this alternative quality, which we all seem to be looking for, which is not conflicted or painful. But in the end, that's an attempt to run away from something, not a... attempt to make contact with someone.
Well, don't you think that a lot of the searching that leads to gurus being the all-powerful, teachers, et cetera, et cetera, comes from a basic yearning not to be in the kind of pain most humans are in, just like Buddha said?
I think that it does, but I think primarily it comes from fear. It comes from the attempt to gain power and control over the context of our life. And even if the deal is with the devil, you know, I'm going to give my personal power authority over to you and you're going to solve my problem. The deal is that if I give my power over, I'm going to be protected. I won't have to experience the pain. I won't have to experience the inherent friction of life, this conflict, that this juxtaposition of the relative world and the absolute, these kinds of things that we're now wrestling with. And that's the deal. But the deal is not a good deal, because the deal always collapses. We always come back to where we are.
So in the end, are you suggesting that people, I think I asked this one way, I'm going to ask it again, simply raise their children, cook their soup,
dance.
I'm suggesting that we
search for more compassion, perhaps? Or?
I'm suggesting that we live our life and that the so-called search become an inquiry. Inquiry meaning that rather than trying to look for an alternative state, that we make contact with the actuality of where we are, all the qualities, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as it's occurring in our life, and we ask the simple question, what is it? Not how do I get away from it? How do I make it better? How do I become something else? But what is it? Because we haven't even discovered what we are yet. So how are we going to know what to do about it or how to do it? And that question of what we are is not just a question of what I am, but what we are, what you and I are, what the community is, what the family is, what the whole of the human race is.
So your message perhaps is just be here now, be doing rather than...
I would say the message is to investigate being rather than investigate doing. Mm-hmm. We are a culture that does inherently, naturally, we're great doers. We can destroy forests and build bridges and huge cities and take over whole continents. Mm-hmm. We've proven we can do, but we have never proven that we can be. And that in our culture, there's not really even respect for being, for the simple act of existing, of being. And when you meet somebody, they say, well, what do you do? Right? First question. It's not what qualities are actually in your life or what is it that expresses in your life, but what do you do? What actions do you take? And it would be nice if we had a culture that also respected the simple act of being.
For some of us who got psychedelicized 30 years ago, we had this paradigm-shifting experience of being and being more than the ego and or the body, et cetera, et cetera. And we spent 30 years now, assuming there is such a thing as 30 years, trying to bring together those two aspects of being, that which is beyond Stephen and Patty and so forth and so on, and that which is Stephen and Patty and so forth and so on. Have you found that there's any kind of perplexity in your life about a shift from...
I think this is a very interesting question, but I think that we have typically approached that question from the relative aspect, trying to draw in the absolute or trying to transform the absolute. And my suggestion on this question of the relative and the absolute is, let the absolute infuse the relative rather than the relative. That is our ideas, our concepts, this idea of me and you trying to grab the absolute, which is what the whole bulk of spirituality is about. It's the interpretation of silence or energy through word.
Is there some kind of a thing between the old spiritual surrender? Is this absolute something that we can simply... We don't have to shape our lives at all, that we can, in your silence, we can simply just allow things to happen?
I think that's exactly it, is that life is actually moving through us.
Oh, that's if nice. I love that. I got to say it again.
Sure. Life is moving through us. This quality of undivided energy consciousness is moving through the relative qualities of our mind-body. That's what's actually happening. But because of this distortion of thought, which by its nature always divides up and always wants to have control, we think, oh, we're going to grab that energy and we're going to use it because we know what to do with it. You know, we're going to save the world, or we're going to overpower this guy, or I'm going to give lectures about this. We try to grab that. Well, that's why it keeps getting distorted. We don't need to grab it.
So in some way, we should sit with it and not try to fix everything, including ourselves.
Yeah, because regardless of what we're trying to do, the effort is wasted. The quality that we're talking about, which is no mind, does not require effort. It infuses everything already. It's the very substratum of our world.
So how do you reach it? We're there. Poor Americans, we're so busy. We got to do this. I got to be here. I got to get money. I got to have a relationship. I got to, have
you
quiet.
Well,
my suggestion in the book is embodied in its title, which is do nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's
easily written.
Sure.
Easily said.
But this is the idea of, like, how do you take a closed fist and open it to receive? Well, there's nothing you can do to relax that fist other than it relaxes. It opens. There is not an action you can do. And this is the whole difficulty of the mind, is the mind searches for the exit in within its own structure. It looks for silence within the field of thought. And there's no silence in the field of thought. There's just more and more thought. There's big thought, bigger thought, really big thought. There's God thought, but it's still thought. And so thought looking for silence in that field can never, ever find it.
Well, I guess that brings us around, and I want to tell people again that we're speaking with Stephen Harrison, author of a most unusual book, Doing Nothing, Coming to the End of the Spiritual Search, which I've quoted online several times. Anyway, I understand that ultimately I'm going to go out in my garden and plant a tomato or something like that. And I suppose that's part of the silence. Nevertheless, perhaps because of my humanity, I'm not sure, there is this great desire to describe the ineffable. And I feel, in spite of your words, that I'm going to go on wondering about what that is and what we are all about. How about you?
Well, I think that the nature of thought and mind is that it does have this thing called curiosity.
Oh, that's
And I don't think that that's going to stop. I don't think that my mind is different than your mind. All the attributes that you can describe about your mind, I will discover in my mind. But I would say this, I don't have any feeling that that curiosity is ever going to find a resolution. And so while I have curiosity, I don't have the irritation that typically goes with curiosity, which says, well, I've got to find that answer today. Because I know that the mind is just structured to do that. That's what it does. But I think that we can find the question, which is different than the answer, the question, the real question, not the curiosity question, but the real question in this ground of silence. And that question, when it contacts each and every thing, changes it. It's like the mirror image. It's like our whole world is turned backwards. That the world of mind seems to be what we're about, what we are. But in fact, it's the world of silence that we are. And mind is just where it plays out.
Okay. So you're silently walking down Pacific Avenue towards Gateways to give your talk to the audience at 2 o'clock.
Yes.
And the rain stops, and you see an older woman sitting on the sidewalk saying, please, I need food, I'm homeless, would you buy me a meal?
Okay.
What does Stephen do?
Well, it really depends entirely on the full context of the situation, but what I would suggest would be the response to this is not just look at the material need of the individual, but the entire context, the entire relationship issue. My take on the individual who says, I need, is not that they need material things, although oftentimes that's part of the expression, but what they really need is relationship, is contact to relationship. My conversations with individuals like this have often gone very deeply into the fact that that individual is not interested in relationship, that they're interested only in the particular form that gives them identity, which is oftentimes that of being impoverished or mentally ill or homeless. And I've had, so in answer to your question in brief, I would generally try to make contact with that individual, as in look them in the eye, as in who are you, how are you, what is your real need here? Now, would I buy them a meal? Sure. Usually what I do in that situation is actually buy them a meal rather than give the individual money, because oftentimes there's a drug or alcohol problem that's really being, you know, foisted on this kind of picture. So this question of what to do for another human being, I think, is a very deep question, and it really requires me to go deeply inside me in relation to that individual.
In some ways, we're talking about compassion in the Buddhist term of feeling what you feel, or empathy. And you speak of Bell's theorem in your book. And just very briefly, Bell's theorem, approved theorem, is that if you stimulate an electron on one side, there's instantaneous stimulation of its twin on the other side. Mm-hmm. How do you see that as changing how we are with each other, and how does that fit in with empathy?
Well, I think that's a very interesting example. The thing about Bell's theorem is that it's not only that it's changing one particle and the other particle changes, but you can take that second particle, once it's had contact with the first particle, you can toss it to the other end of the universe, and you can affect the first particle, and still that second particle is changed. So that there's no distance. There's no space. I mean, this is a very interesting thing about quantum physics. It's talking about what the mystics are talking about, which is there's no time and space. So what this means is, in the example of I come in contact with this person who has a need, I can walk by and pretend I don't see that person. The fact is that person and I, on a fundamental particulate way, are in relation to each other, regardless. And so I can say, oh, I don't need to do anything about this, but the fact is my need for my own self is to do something, is to have some response. And so I think this is the molecular basis of empathy, is that somewhere we understand that we are the same, that something that touches you touches me, that someone who is dying of starvation in Africa is somewhere in me. And this is where the interest in finding out really what this is that we are is so important.
So we're back into time, in a sense, because if enough people, for instance, heed your book, Doing Nothing, and change enough inside so that they recognize that total interdependence, then the person in Africa dying of hunger probably won't, because we'll see to it that there's an equitable distribution of food.
And
so there is time.
Well, but it's not so much that the person in Africa won't die, but it's that I won't die. You see, it's not in Africa. It's my own poverty, my own disconnection. See, we don't die generally here of lack of food. We die here of lack of empathy. Lack of love.
Oh, I love this. Go ahead. You do discuss the possibility of immortality in the flesh in your book some.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is we're going to go off on a tangent, but let's go there. But I think it's when you go into the question of time, when you say, well, now we're moving into time to save this person in Africa. Now we've separated the world. We've now created a conceptual framework. There's me, who's doing fine, and there's this guy in Africa who's dying. Well, of course we're in time now, because we've created a conceptual framework. But when we actually experience that Bell's theorem of the heart, which is that your pain is in fact in me, it's not in you, it's in me, there's no time. And now that movement of saving somebody, there's no somebody to save. There's just something in me that has to be understood, which is why I'm starving.
Well, I predicated my life for a while on the assumption that we invented time to change, to learn how to direct change, which is exactly the opposite of what you're talking about in a lot of ways, and that we can, in fact, change the fulcrum somehow of the duality balance, so that a lot of the so-called evil, I mean, I don't know what words to mm-hmm. use, so we have to use the traditional words, mm-hmm. falls away forever. Mm-hmm. And once it's fallen away, it will never have existed mm-hmm. in a sense. Mm-hmm. And so I would hate, in a way, for us to totally be into the silence unless that change also could occur, so that the person inside me who has pain and the person in Africa who's dying of hunger, neither any longer exists.
But I want to make clear, I'm not equating silence with nihilism or inaction
okay.
or some kind of inert quality. I mean, this is a kind of a spiritual image that we have, that silence means that we just stop doing. We're sitting in a cave someplace. It's sealed off. It's dark. Mm-hmm. Not at all. And to me, silence is where the conceptual framework, which keeps us divided, falls away. In that moment, there's direct action. There's very, very direct action.
Okay.
So I'm suggesting quite the opposite, that the thing that keeps us from taking that action, whatever that action may be, whatever we discovered, is this conceptual framework. And this is what actually happens in our process when we meet that person that has that need, is we have all this clutter that's in between, all the judgments, all the considerations, all the ideas, and there's no direct action. We can't even see who's in front of us, who's actually inside us. We can't feel that to know what action to take. And sometimes that action is to walk by. Sometimes that action is to give. Sometimes the action is to bring that person into your home. But you can't know that because we're so cluttered. So I'm describing actually a world where we all become actors because we're all responsible.
I have to ask you again, because I get confused between the two realities of being and becoming. How do you unclutter?
Well, let's start with where we are. Where we are is we are cluttered.
Right.
Right?
That's what
now,
you said.
Okay. We inhabit a world which is full of thoughts coming and going, and in those thoughts there's a macro thought that wraps around them all that says, I am, these are my thoughts, this is my life. That's where we start, okay? What do I do about that? Well, the actor, the doer says, what I do about that is the same thing as the thoughts themselves. Whatever my conditioning is, that's what I should do about it. But what happens is we now have all the stuff that was happening plus more of the stuff that was happening, because that's just replicating itself. It's like a mutant gene or something that just all it knows how to do is more of itself. And so what do you do in the face of that? Is this, my suggestion is, you don't do anything in relation to that. The doing nothing is not about concrete action. It's about psychological action. It's about how we relate to our own mind structures. And the very not doing is a very powerful response. It's very difficult, it seems, for us to even think about or ideate what that means.
That's what I'm asking.
Yes, we have not. Well, there's no conceptual response to that. You know, it's a negative. It's an approach through not an approach through doing. And so I'm saying, let's take the energy out of the whole mental framework, and let's let the energy be where it is, which is this awareness, this backdrop. And then see what arises out of that. And rather than describe what that is, which now becomes the foreground, the thought, and another concept, I'm saying let's get rid of the clutter first, and then the inquiry becomes, well, what actually is expressing out of this substratum of life? And it seems to me, because that is whole, when you go into that field of awareness, you can't find division in it. You can't find anything that's disconnected. Because that's whole, its expression then will be whole. And if we live from that, then it will express wholeness.
Early on, you talked about groups of people, and I didn't ask you to expand what your vision is. I'd like to hear about that.
Okay.
And what, suppose people got together and sat around in a living room, as it were.
Well, that's a lot of actually what I'm doing right now, is sitting around in living rooms with groups of people.
Oh, really?
And exploring what actually happens in that when it's not directed through some kind of philosophic outlook that we all agree upon, you know, that we're going to have some agreed upon result from that. that it's not about worshiping anything or anyone, and it's not about any spiritual authority. And yet we all have an intense interest in discovering what the structures of mind are and how relationship can grow out of this commonality, out of this field of awareness.
So, Stephen, do we sit around sort of like a Quaker meeting?
Well, having been raised as a Quaker, I love the attempt of Quakerism to give form to that. But Quakerism is, I think, unfortunately, embedded in Christianity. And so it, by that nature, has already divided itself from huge populations of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's again, subtract Quakerism from Quakerism and make it into a truly dynamic exploration rather than an accepted homeostasis. Quakerism has accepted a certain form,
mm-hmm.
and it repeats that form each Sunday in a certain way. But I don't know if we start out sitting around in the living room, maybe we, you know, next month some other thing takes place. Maybe we find that taking walks together or doing movement or doing art, or maybe there's some form that we haven't discovered yet.
That's what I think.
Yeah. But
I think there's a form we haven't discovered yet.
Okay.
That puts us right back into time.
Well, but the discovery of that is only going to take place in this moment, this instant. It's never going to take place in time. And so while we may step back from that and say, well, it will be in time, that's a way of distancing ourselves from it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that the potential is right here. The exploration is right here in this living room, this group of people sitting around. We're doing it right
now.
We're
doing it.
That's right. And it's a very dynamic place. Dynamic meaning it's in motion, and yet the motion is without time. The change is without time.
I've been very influenced by the I Ching. And the I Ching is a template that describes the various ways of becoming.
Mm-hmm.
It describes the movement of the universe. And I cannot help but think that somehow or other, if time is an invention, and it seems to me as though it is, because I, on the one hand, I said I see myself aging, so there it seems as though it isn't, but I see my cat existing outside of the structure I call time. If it's an invention that started sometime or other in historical times, it seems as though it must have a purpose beyond just stepping out of it.
Well, I think that there is a concrete kind of time. There is the what the I Ching describes, which is the endless cycles that we
yes.
can observe, the rising of the sun.
Okay.
That is a chronological time that we can all agree occurs. There's not a problem with that. The problem is psychological time, which is this capturing of concrete time by the psychological me.
Mm-hmm.
And psychological time, which is what we use to pressure ourselves and motivate ourselves and control ourselves and all this stuff, and it's become this horrible influence in our world. I went by a local bakery in Santa Cruz where the sign over the door said, welcome, you've got plenty of time.
Yeah.
Right?
Emily's
Bakery. Yeah, Emily's Bakery.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an excuse for really bad service. A very interesting statement that people generally think that there isn't plenty of time.
No, yeah, I have a nice cookie or something and coffee, right?
Yeah, so this is the aberration, is when psychological time comes into play. And now, psychological time comes from thought. Thought creates it each and every moment. It drives us from moment to moment, and it creates this past and future. We always have the past memory that of what we did, and we have this future of what we're going to do, and of course, we're always stretched then outside of where we actually are. And that's the problem. The collapsing back into the moment where we actually are is the access, is the portal, is the doorway to this universal expansion.
Mm. You know, how do people who reach that state function in an American schizoid society? How do you come back and do what you need to do? Whatever you're doing, teaching or
mm-hmm.
making money.
I think that we have to all live that. I mean, in this room right now, we're taking our time. We are taking the time to be present. And I think we have to, each and every one of us, do that in the myriad ways that we live our lives. And I think that's a much more powerful force than what I see as an inherently unstable and ultimately not powerful force, which is all the apparent pressure that is on us all the time to, you know, to be rushing and be hurried and to be under this kind of contraction. So I think it's actually easy, generally, to be spacious. Now, it may mean you have to simplify your life, you have to declutter your world, but so what? Let's do that. And it may mean different kinds of institutions. Different. We may have to do things more collectively or communally or cooperatively so that there's not so much money pressure and consequently time pressure. So that may require those kinds of changes in our culture. But that's a good change, it seems to me.
We don't have a whole lot of time left. And I could go on forever with you. Right, this is a wonderful conversation. I wondered if you'd like to read, is there a section of the book you feel that an aware audience
might? It's from a chapter entitled Inquiry. Life is dynamic. It is changing, moving. Because we risk becoming dogmatic and conceptualized in our life, it is important to push at the edges of our understanding. Realization of the absolute is not the end, but the beginning of inquiry into that absolute. Recognizing the limitation of the conditioned state is not the end of the state. Our question becomes the investigation of that conditioned state and its transformation. This integration of the absolute and the relative, the conditioned and the unconditioned, is a kind of evolution of consciousness which is taking place in all of us, but which is taking place outside of time. So that'll give a little feeling for the flavor of the book.
Well, let's tell people once again that we've been talking with Stephen Harrison, author of Doing Nothing, coming to the end of the spiritual search. Hooray!
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming over in this rainy day.
Yes.
And what's your next book, very rapidly?
It's going to be called Getting to Where You Are. And it's going to be about different kinds of meditation, what they're useful for, what their limitations are, and what do we do with this in our day-to-day life. So it's going to be kind of an extension of this first book.
Great. We'll see each other again, I hope.
I hope so.
Right.
Good.